The constant hum of insects came the frequent chirps and trills from birds and lizards. She focused on a nearby rustling and aimed her arrowless bow before drawing the string. The muscles in her shoulders and arms burned fiercely and her fingertips were raw from a morning of practice, yet she ignored the pain. This she would do again and again until it no longer hurt. Maddock never warned her when he threw the rock to flush out a target. Now the stone crashed through the grass, followed by a squawk and flap of wings. A pheasant burst out of the grasses and Yvonne loosed her string. There was not yet a satisfying p'ting when she released her imagined arrow, yet she grinned happily again, for she was certain her aim had been true and the bird would have been an evening stew. "When I have quicker eyes and a stronger arm, I'll kill suppers for us all," she told Maddock. "I will be the greatest hunter with bow and arrow you have ever seen." His grin matched hers.
"It will serve Torek and Danal well to have new competition."
Because those two warriors were the best archers among the dragon, Yvonne could never hope to be as strong as they, but their skill was not all in strength. "I shall ask them for lessons, too."
"You learn faster than your current tutor did,"
said Artel dryly as she came up beside Yvonne's mount at a trot.
"You are only a day into your lessons, but you already boast as mightily as Maddock did when he reached his bearded age and claimed he would be the greatest hunter the Burning Plains had ever seen."
She was being teased, Yvonne realized with a rush of dizzying pleasure, teased as the warriors often teased Maddock, though Artel had not spared him in this either. Yvonne hoped Artel might ride alongside her and continue that teasing, but she joined the two warriors ahead. Bannock and Keeler had ridden in front of Maddock and Yvonne all morning. Now Artel didn't seem intent on talking to either, but simply riding with them, and they all seemed bunched into a smaller party without as much distance between their horses. She glanced back and saw that Fasad and Torek were nearly on her mount's hindquarters with Dano not far behind. Immediately, Maddock asked,
"Do you sense foul magics again?"
"I only noticed that we ride closer together now." And Yvonne had learned that the warriors did nothing without reason. "For what purpose? Do you expect that it still follows us?" Whatever it had been, that uneasy, watchful touch at the back of her neck. But if the threat was behind, Yvonne realized, then Artel would not have moved to the front.
"I know not if it does,"
Maddock said.
"This is another danger."
Tension gripped the back of her neck. "Are there bandits ahead?"
"Linen thieves."
Which sounded to Yvonne like bandits until he added,
"You might call them Uzads."
A flightless, predatory bird. Fascinated, Yvonne searched for them and spotted the head of one sticking up over the tall grasses and saw why the Parsathians had named them linen thieves. The red wattle around its beak and neck appeared as if a warrior's red linens hung from its mouth.
"I had not thought them so big."
If the grasses ahead grew as high as they did here, it meant the animal stood even taller than Maddock upon his horse. "I only see one. Are there more?"
"One more, a female. Except for when they nest, linen thieves hunt alone."
"So they are not like Drapa?" The large feathered lizards that roamed the burning plains in packs. Yvonne's mother had described them very similarly, though Drapa used their raptor claws to tear out the innards of their prey, while Uzads bashed in skulls with their heavy beaks.
"I would rather face a pack of Drapa than a nesting linen thief,"
Maddock said grimly.
"A group such as ours has little to fear from a single bird. It will chase easier prey. But a pair protecting their young will defend their territory."
A territory that the road traveled straight through. Yvonne's heart beat a faster pace. "What do we do?"
"Prepare to ride hard."
So she would need both hands. Yvonne slung her bow across her back. "Are linen thieves quick?" Maddock nodded.
"Faster than a horse at a sprint. When we reach the edge of their territory, the dogs will draw them away from the road. Then we'll race through."
Already her palms were clammy. Yvonne dried them on her robes before grasping her reins. "Where is the edge of their territory?"
"We will know."
By the stench, apparently. The light breeze stirring the grasses brought the stomach-churning scent of rotting flesh to Yvonne's nose. More animals entered the linen thieves' territory than the nesting birds could eat, and their bodies marked the boundary the linen thieves defended. The Parsathians drew to a halt when the first carcass appeared on the road ahead, covered by a swarm of black flies. In a cloud, the flies lifted and settled again, revealing the grisly remains of a horse. Near to it was what appeared to be a Miran, lying upon its armored back with its belly battered open. But it was not only animals that the linen thieves had killed. Silently, Maddock gestured to another fly-swarmed carcass that might have been man or woman.
"That is why we have seen no bandits." "That one almost made it through,"
Keeler added.
"No doubt we'll come across what is left of his friends and their horses on the road ahead, so mind the footing." Being tossed from a saddle after a mount slips in a bandit's guts is a good tale for a round of fire, but we'll not be so merry here.
Mind the footing. Nervousness crept up Yvonne's spine. She had planned to simply hold on and let her horse follow the others, yet she would need to guide her mount? A loud hiss sent another shiver racing up her spine. The linen thief stepped into the road, neck extended and waving from side to side. It flapped wings that were too small for its huge body, as if trying to make itself seem larger, but it did not need to be larger. Already it looked terrifyingly big. Yvonne's roan pranced uneasily, and she patted her shoulder, trying to soothe the mare, though her own hands were shaking, and the hairs lifted at the back of her neck. But that was not because of the linen thief. That was something else. Something close.
Matic, she said urgently.
He glanced at her just as Bone and Steel began growling. Neither wolf faced the linen thief, but had turned east, facing the direction from which they'd come. Ahead, Keeler had not taken his eyes from the giant bird.
What is it?
Nothing on the road behind them, yet Matic had taught her how to watch the grasses to see the direction an animal moved and to guess at its size. Even with the breeze disturbing the stalks, she detected movement heading in their direction. Many movements heading in their direction, some approaching very quickly. But the warriors were not only looking for dangers in the grass. Dana pointed into the sky.
Redfoot Eagle! She called out.
That announcement flew through the dragon like an arrow. As one, they spun to face the linen thief, horses snorting and pawing as if preparing to sprint forward.
The nesting female?
Keeler asked, voice tense.
We cannot wait,
Matic told him, reaching for the bronze shield hanging from the back of his saddle.
As soon as the male chases the wolves from the road, fly.
What is coming?
Fear made Yvonne's voice high and thready, though she was not even certain what she feared. The linen thief, yes, but not nearly as much as the unknown things behind them.
What threat is the eagle?
It is Easel.
Her second brother?
Yvonne tried to make sense of Maddox's answer, then bit back a surprised cry when he reached over and snagged her waist, lifting her from the saddle. In the next moment she was settled in front of him. He threw a command at Torek to lead her horse. A word from Fassad sent the wolves racing down the road. The linen thief ruffled its feathers and hissed its warning as they swiftly closed the distance.
Hold tight,
Maddox said, and she felt his steely tension as they watched Bone and Steel. As soon as the linen thief gave chase, there would be no talking.
What do you mean it is Easel?
Redfoot eagles nest only in the Fallen Mountains.
In her brother's territory of Rugus.
Likely your brother controls the eagle and sees through its eyes, as Stranek's priests once did. To cast their spells from afar, they needed to see what their magics would touch, so they sent birds as familiars.
And those priests had sacrificed children to their god for that power, using sight beyond what was seen, but gained through evil means. Rage and horror erupted like bile in her throat, nearly choking her.
You think Easel did the same?
To locate our route.
Anger hardened his voice.
Now he uses his foul magic to make revenants.
Also as Stranek's priests had done, reanimating dead animals and sending the ravenous creatures to attack the Alliance army. With a shudder, Yvonne pictured the multiple trails that signaled movement through the grass.
How many revenants come?
Only a dozen.
The answer filled her with terror.
Only?
He added grimly.
If your brother continues to use his magics, there will soon be more.
Because the linen thieves' territory would be littered with carcasses, likely far more than had fallen along the road and that they could see, and those the warriors were making certain could not get up again. Torek, Ardal, and Bannock swiftly moved among the fallen animals, sweeping low in their saddles to stab through the rotting skulls and necks, sending up swarms of buzzing flies.
Dragon at the round sides!
Keeler said sharply, and the other warriors fell in beside and behind Maddox's horse. From farther behind them came a crashing through the grasses, a wet snarling that grew louder. Days upon the road had taught Yvonne that almost nothing made loud noise. Predators crept toward their prey. The prey avoided notice of predators if they could. Ahead, though the wolves fainted toward the linen thief's legs before darting away, the huge bird seemed not to notice them at all anymore, beaded eyes focused ahead, head lifted high. With a loud honk, the linen thief whirled and dodged into the grass, the red wattle waving like a flag as the bird raced through the tall stalks. Beneath her, the horse's muscles bunched. Maddox's hard chest pressed against her back and she leaned forward, gripping the saddle tight as the Parsathian surged forward as one. This was not the first time they had raced together in this way. Yet before, wonder had filled Yvonne, exhilaration. Now only fear clutched her throat and pounded through her veins as she desperately clung to the pommel.
Other warriors pressed in around them, the dragon's protection a shield of their own horses and bodies. Wind whipped tears from her eyes. She didn't dare shift her weight and glance behind, probably couldn't have seen anything past Matic anyway. Only what was forward and directly to the side. She looked over as Dana turned in her saddle to loose an arrow behind. An unholy screech answered as if the arrow had found its mark, but Yven could not imagine what creature might make such a terrible noise. Even the blood wraiths had not sounded so viscerally ravenous. The linen thieves bolted out of the grass and onto the road ahead of Keeler. A scream of warning ripped from Yven, but the birds were not bent on attack. Balls of fluff were tucked beneath their small wings as they sprinted ahead down the road. Carrying their young away instead of trying to fight the revenants coming from behind? And that was more terrifying than anything else, that the predators even the Parsathians had feared were fleeing the foul creatures. Though he was directly behind her, Matic had to shout over the thunder of her heart and the hooves.
"Does Isa want you dead?"
She shook her head. Her brother didn't, or so she believed. As a bride and Nyset's heir, she was more valuable to them alive. But if Ezel had sent these revenants after them, Yven couldn't be so certain. Her answer seemed to change the tension in Matic's form behind her. He didn't shout again, yet must have communicated a command to the others, because Keeler held up his fist in acknowledgement. That order was apparently to find a defensible location. They splashed across a wide stream and Keeler came to a halt. All the warriors suddenly seemed in purposeful motion, the horses snorting and prancing in wide circles. Relief filled Yven when she saw steel and bone at Fassad's heels. Swiftly, Keeler dismounted.
"Put your bride on mine!"
Yven knew not what he meant, but she found herself placed atop Keeler's horse a moment later.
"Stay mounted,"
Matic told her, though he and most of the other warriors were abandoning their saddles as well.
"This gelding won't bolt while we fight, but if we are overwhelmed, ride at speed until you find a village."
Yven could do nothing except nod, her breath coming in heavy rushes. Her own horse and the others Matic had bought were untrusted to remain steady while the revenants attacked, and only Torek and Dana were mounted now. Yven was sitting amid the riderless horses, the Parsathian mounts on either side of her, the newer ones tied together in a snorting, nervous line. Ahead, the warriors formed an arc across the road, preparing to fight any revenants who crossed the stream. The creatures would be exposed while fording the waters, so there could be no unexpected attacks from the grasses around them.
"Ezel will not risk his sister,"
Matic told them,
"so he will fly the eagle in close to better control the revenants. We hold here until Dana and Torek take Ezel's eyes."
By shooting the eagle from the sky. Still panting from that desperate ride, Yven watched the trails through the grass, counting more than a dozen now, some faster than others. Most warriors were not mounted to see. She had opened her mouth to call out a warning when Fassad gave it instead, alerted by the wolves, she realized. The creature that burst through the grasses on the opposite side of the stream had once been a linen thief, but was now a shambling horror, within a loose, rotting skin covered in ragged feathers. It darted into the stream, hissing wetly from a gristly throat, slowed by the knee-deep water.
"Fassad!"
Matic said. The warrior's arrow pierced its skull with a fleshy thunk. Another revenant erupted from the grasses, a louth. The same sort of creature that had rooted harmlessly near Yven's head that morning, diseased and flying toward them on its splayed feet. This time Bannock's arrow felled it while crossing the stream.
"He is raising more corpses from nearby,"
Keeler said grimly.
"Even a revenant louth is not fast enough to have caught up to us."
And could not have been one of the creatures that had been behind them at the edge of the linen thieves' territory. The eagle soared nearer, and Yven watched with held breath as first Dana and then Torek loosed arrows. Dana's sharp curse followed when they both missed, though not by much. Yven's heart thundered as they tried again before the eagle circled north away from the stream. More revenants approached, and she bit her tongue to stop from calling out a warning, knowing it wasn't needed and might be a distraction. Each of the warriors faced where the wolves indicated, but no revenant burst through.
"It stopped at the edge of the grasses,"
Yven called out. She saw the uneasy glance Keeler and Matic shared then.
"What is it?"
"Your brother has realized that we will defeat the revenants easily if they cross one at a time."
It was Bannock who answered her.
"So he will gather them there until he can make them attack in great numbers."
"He is no experienced sorcerer,"
Keeler said with a glance at Yven.
"Is he?"
"I do not believe so. I never felt this magic when he lived in the citadel in Sicia, and he only took Rugus's throne a few seasons past."
"Then he will not find it easy to hold the revenants here and reanimate more and chase our archers."
Matic looked to Torek and Dano.
"Ride."
Both warriors looked pleased by that command. Together they charged north through the grasses, and Yven followed their progress as it abruptly shifted east across the stream again. The eagle made two tighter circles above a rock covered by a swarm of birds before angling east. At first, Torek and Danil seemed to be heading in the wrong direction, not toward the eagle at all, until Yven realized they were cutting across the wide circle Ezel's familiar was making.
"How many, Yven?"
Maddox's voice brought her gaze swinging back to the grasses across the stream. She was the only one with a view over the tall stalks now.
"I think 8 or 9, wait."
Grimly, he nodded.
"That is my count. They are not quiet in their approach."
"At least a dozen more are coming."
Approaching from the wide expanse of grasses, the trails they made far apart, yet clearly converging in this direction. Nervously, her gaze shot back to Torek and Danil, who rode not far from some of the Revenant's trails, but the creature seemed not at all interested in the riders galloping through the grasses. She didn't know if her brother hadn't noticed the Parsathian archers, or if he simply couldn't split his focus in that way.
"Tell us when they strike the eagle down,"
Maddox said. Because the Revenants across the stream would not be held back by her brother then, and would attack their party. That fight could not be avoided, but hopefully the eagle would be struck down before more Revenants arrived. They'd passed so many corpses on that race through the Linen Thief's territory. A sorcerer could not raise dead humans without a demon's assistance, but there'd been fallen animals aplenty for her brother to reanimate, and those were only upon the road. With a sharp whistle in command, Fassad sent the wolves to Yven's side. Not only to guard her, she knew. The wolves and the horses might only be tools, but they were too useful to risk, and putting any of the animals in a battle with Revenants guaranteed their death. A bite or scratch from a Revenant was poison to a human, but to a living animal, the Revenant's poison would change them into the same. Palms clammy with cold sweat, her brother's foul magic breathing down the back of her neck, she looked out over the grasses again. Torek and Danil seemed almost directly below the eagle. With awe, she saw that they did not even slow from a full gallop as they took aim. It seemed the arrow's flight was as swift as the pounding of her heart, released at one beat, and on the next beat, Torek's shaft pierced the eagle's breast.
"It is killed!" she cried.
Even as the eagle tumbled from the sky, the ravenous growls from the stream burst into terrifying howls. She didn't recognize the animal that leapt the stream without slowing. An antelope, perhaps, its hide hanging in sheets from withered bones, head lowered and antlers jutting like spikes. Grunting, Matic blocked the spikes with his shield and jammed his sword up through the creature's snapping jaw. With a double-armed swing of his axe, Keeler split the skull of a charging bison. At the edge of the stream, Artel spun her glaive in an upward slash that beheaded a cowled lizard, then scrambled back as the big animal fell, viscous black blood spurting from the long, writhing neck. Bannock felled a yellow-horned lay beast, sword impaling its soft underjaw. Yven drew in a breath to cry warning as another bison charged across the stream at him, but with shield at his chest, Fassad rammed into the beast as it reached the bank, knocking it off stride. The warrior stabbed through its rolling eye with a short sword, while the wolves snarled and whined by the legs of Yven's mount, bodies quivering with the need to rush forward and help. With the same helpless frustration, Yven watched the battle, until movement north caught her attention. The nesting crows were winging upward in raucous flight, and the rock they'd settled upon had not been a rock. This creature she recognized, though she'd only seen one before at a distance. Maddox had said whiptails were as tall as trees, and though this one was still a sprint away, it stood taller than any tree Yven had seen. Its legs were like trees, and the neck and tail each longer than the span of its giant, hump-backed body. Terror in her heart, she looked to Maddox. In the moment after he struck down another Revenant, when it was not so dangerous to distract him, she shouted, "Maddox, to the north!" She saw him glance in that direction, his face covered in gore, before he raised his shield against another Revenant that crossed the stream. The warrior slowly began falling back toward the horses, the defensive arc they made across the road smaller and tighter. On the other side of the stream, Danil and Torek galloped toward the whiptail. Their arrows pierced the hide but were only like the stings of bees to the enormous reptile. And the trails through the grasses were not all converging now. One crept slowly toward the mounted Parsathians.
"Torek!"
Yven screamed the warning.
"Behind you!"
The young warrior had but a moment to turn, shield in front of his chest, when the creature leapt at him. A long-toothed cat, only recently dead, its yellow fur still spotted instead of rotting away in clumps. The Revenant slammed into the shield, knocking Torek from his saddle. Yven heard Dano's faint cry, and then the warrior surged from her horse with axe in hand. The thrashing of the grasses was all Yven could see then. A deafening roar clutched at her heart. The whiptail. It had not been looking in their direction, but Yven's scream had drawn its attention.
Not even in her nightmares could she have imagined such a creature. Not even the trap jaw had been so big. Beside the whiptail, even that great predator would have been as a wolf next to a mammoth. No fangs or claws the whiptail revenant had, yet the foul magic that reanimated the decaying brain within its small head and moved its mountain of rotting meat cared nothing about the original purpose of its host, and teeth that stripped leaves from giant palms could tear frail human flesh from bones. The ground itself shook when the whiptail took a step, then another, faster with each earthquaking stride. Its huge belly had split, bloodied entrails spilling out and dragging along the ground. Through torn skin and gaping wounds, the whiptail rained gore as it came. Other revenants were still coming too, not all at once as the first burst had been, but still so many the warriors could not turn away from the stream for more than a moment. They could not run. Unlike horses, the revenants would not slow or tire.
"Ranmatic!"
Keeler shouted, grunting as he slammed his axe into the skull of a louth.
"Take your bride! We will hold them!"
Perhaps the small revenants could be held, but that whiptail could not be. It would be like a mouse trying to hold back a horse. Keeler's axe might chop through the meat of those tree-like legs, but it could not crack the solid bones at their centers. Even a mounted Parsathian with a glaive could not swing the blade high enough to reach that snake-like neck. The warriors would die, and Matic would never leave them. Only a perfectly placed arrow into the brain might fell that monster, yet both Dana and Torek were unseated, battling the long-toothed cat at no angle to strike the whiptail's small head. Matic's fiery gaze shot to Yvain.
"Ride!"
The rage of helplessness clutched at her chest. She looked to the charging whiptail. Had she only more than a day's practice, she'd have had the strength to kill it, but she did have strength. She had chosen him for that reason. Urgent purpose gripped her heart. Keeler's bow and quiver was strapped to the cantle of his saddle. Untying the weapon, she slid from the tall horse, careful to land on her right leg. She hobbled as fast as she could toward Matic, notching the arrow and the string. Matic shoved a revenant from the end of his sword and glanced over his shoulder. She knew not what to make of his expression when he saw her coming, carrying Keeler's bow and arrow. It seemed molten and icy at once, full of anger and fear. A hoarse, short laugh broke from him, and he turned back toward the stream.
"Now is not the time for practice, my warrior queen. It is time to ride away."
"Help me, and I will kill it!" He whirled on her, eyes on fire. With steely arm, he snatched her against his side, tucked between his body and his shield.
"Bannock!"
he roared.
"Take my bride and..."
"Matic!" She reached up and jerked at his beard, slick with the blackened blood of revenants. "I am Nyset's heir. The goddess Vela looks through my eyes. She will guide my aim, but I need your strength." His head snapped down, his dark gaze searching hers. Only a breath passed before he was suddenly behind her, all around her. His left hand gripped the bow beneath her grip, his fingers closed over her fingers, and it was as if his hands were hers when they pulled the bowstring together. The creak of the wooden bow as it bent was the sweetest of music. She recalled Bannock's tale of Queen Venice, the stolen iron, and a beast felled with one arrow. The whiptail was many times larger than any Kurgan, but surely had the same vulnerability.
"The eye?"
she asked, because Yvain believed it would be the same but could not be certain, yet Matic always saw every weakness.
"The eye,"
he replied. The whiptail thundered toward them, quaking the ground. She only had to look at her target and knew the aim was true, and as if her fingers were Matic's, he released as she did. The vibrating pting of the string filled her heart with such happiness that the slash of pain across her forearm was nothing. Never had an arrow's flight seemed so swift and true. With held breath, she watched it streak upward before plunging into the whiptail's infested eye. For a long moment, she feared it might have been only another bee sting to the great beast. Another step the monster took, then another, and then, suddenly, it pitched forward. Almost slowly, it seemed to fall, an endless beat before the impact of the enormous body shook the ground beneath her feet and blew through the grasses like a putrid gale storm, bending the stalks in a wave along the stream. Sheer silence reigned for a moment. Silence from the warriors, from the revenants, even the buzzing of the insects quieted. Then another wet growl sounded, and Matic shifted his grip on the bow.
"You used the wrong arm,"
he told her. And indeed she had, notching the arrow and using the grip most familiar to her, though her fingers were missing. But now he switched their grips, his right hand holding the bow beneath hers and supporting her missing fingers, his left hand assisting hers in notching the arrow on the string.
"The eye again,"
he said when a Mirren revenant began fording the stream. It mattered not that the target was smaller and guarded by armored spikes above the eye.
Again, Maddox's fingers released when Yvenne's did, and her arrow found its mark. The Miran dropped dead halfway across the stream, submerged in the bloodied waters with the bodies of other revenants. A whoop sounded from Keeler, and breathless laughter from the other warriors, and her own joy almost burst her heart.
"The next is a horse," Maddox said. "The eyes are at the side of its head and not the front."
"How can you tell what it is?" Yvenne could see nothing coming, could only hear it crash through the tall stalks.
"The rhythm of its steps,"
he told her, and she could hear it now too, a pattern that had become so familiar during this journey.
"We are directly in front, so it will turn its head to better see us. Let loose the arrow then."
She did, and the charging beast plunged to the ground. Immediately she turned toward the sound of more hooves pounding through the grasses. This time Maddox halted her aim.
"That is Dana and Torek."
Both riding, Yvenne was relieved to see. But behind her, Maddox stiffened.
"Were you bit?"
A bloody gash on Torek's leg was already reddened and swollen. The young warrior nodded, though he was grinning as he held up a spotted pelt.
"Though I have a new fur to wear."
Dana stared at the fallen whiptail with furrowed brow, and then she eyed Yvenne with Maddox behind her, their hands still ready on her bow. Any question she might have had was answered when another revenant burst from the grasses, and together they loosed a bow that pierced its eye. Laughing, Ardal dipped the blade of her glaive into the stream to wash the steel clean.
"Maddox's bride was not boasting. With practice, she will be the finest hunter with bow and arrow we have ever seen."
From her perch atop the horse, Dana looked out over the grasses.
"That is the last one, or at least the last one near enough to see."
A maelstrom of conflicting emotions filled Yvenne. Sorry there were not more to kill, and exhilarated by what she and Maddox had done and glad the danger was over, then utterly surprised when Maddox's massive arms suddenly wrapped around her and she felt the press of his face into her hair, holding her so close, so tight, as if she were more to him than a vessel. Then his voice sounded low and harsh in her ear, hot with anger.
"You vowed to follow orders that would keep you safe, yet you disobeyed."
Hurt speared through her. "I vowed I would not fail in my duty toward you and your dragon. Killing the whiptail kept us all safe."
"Your duty is not to protect us."
With aching heart, she argued. "It is a queen's duty to protect—"
"You are not their queen yet, but only my bride. When you have strength of your own, you may kill all the whiptails you like. Otherwise, you will stay on the horse."
Abruptly, he let her go, then lifted her astride Keeler's gelding again. His face was grim as he looked to Torek.
"There will be more coming. We must find a more defensible camp. Can you ride hard now?"
The young warrior nodded, but he would not for long, not with the revenant's poison within him. Maddox turned to Keeler.
"Do we have any of Nemec's potions with us?"
"Made by that god's blessed healers, and which might draw out the poison to prevent the dangerous fever." The scarred warrior shook his head, his gore-painted face a mask of tension. Maddox glanced up at Yvenne. She knew what he silently asked. Throat tight, she said, "I have none either." And warriors did not wish for what they did not have. But this time, they all did. Chapter 21. Yvenne. They had ridden quickly that morning, but it was nothing compared to the pace they set for the remainder of the day. Three times revenants caught up to the riders. The creatures were no longer under her brother's control, but were still fixated on the humans as prey, their scent easy to trail on the road, and unlike the horses, the revenants never needed to slow or to rest. By sunset, the tall grasses had given way to green marshlands studded with groves of giant ferns. Ahead lay the scattered remains of Hanan's colossal statue that had once straddled the banks of the Agaris River. Exhaustion stole any amazement or wonder that Yvenne might have mustered at the sight of the gargantuan head, half buried in the earth, its sculpted eyelashes so lifelike that the breeze stirring through them gave the appearance of the god stirring to wakefulness. It was full dark before Maddox called a halt beside the statue's head, because they could ride no farther. A flushed and fevered Torek was swaying in his saddle. As Maddox helped Yvenne down, they saw the young warrior slide unbalanced from his mount, caught at the last moment by Bannock. Pushing aside her fatigue, Yvenne told Maddox, "If you tend to my horse, I will tend to Torek." She knew not why his jaw tightened and his expression darkened, and she had little care, nor did she care to hear any answer from him but agreement. If someone else looks after him, there will be one less warrior to stand watch tonight, though both revenants and soldiers might be behind us, she pointed out, and I am no stranger to caring for someone weakened by poison. That dark gaze searched her face for a moment before he gave a short nod.
You may.
She would have anyway, just as she would continue shooting arrows into the eyes of monsters, with or without the approval of her would-be husband.
But although her throat ached when Madoc led away Keeler's horse without leaving her the warrior's bow, it was not the moment to wage that battle. The bite on Torek's leg was inflamed, the edges of the ragged wound swollen. While the others set up camp in the marble shelter formed by the statue's cheek and nose, she and Bannock helped the young warrior to his furs. His fevered face reddened more when she settled beside him and opened the small pot of salve Bannock had given her.
"You ought not, my lady. Take your meal and rest."
"After you have taken yours." Gently she smeared the medicine over the wound, glad to see that despite the swelling and the heat, no pus seeped out. Still, it must have been tender. Instead of asking his usual questions, Torek sat with gritted teeth until she finished. As she put the salve aside, his gaze briefly touched her eyes.
"Do you sense him now?"
"Her brother." "Not since the eagle fell. By your arrow," she added, her voice warm with praise. He blushed so fiercely his cheeks looked aflame. His gaze met hers before he averted his eyes again, and his voice was low as he confessed,
"I never thought to see such things, wraiths and revenants. Those horrors only belonged to tales. Even the scourge is nothing now but a pile of black glass and stone."
"Such creatures were but tales for me too," she said softly, "and her father and brothers the only monsters."
"They have seen them in the march across the lave against Stranek's Fang."
A lift of his chin indicated Madoc and Keeler, who were returning to the fire with the skinned and gutted makings of dinner.
"And old Bannock here." "So I have,"
was the warrior's reply.
"But I never met any such creatures upon the lave. There were only animals that might kill us, but that is no different from home, excepting the Farians, who might also kill us. Why do they want to?"
"The savages?" Torek nodded.
"Did your mother watch them?"
"Many of my foremothers did, but I do not think they ever made sense of the Farians' ways."
"The Tolehi monks believe that they view us as demons, and that is why they are desperate to kill us."
He looked to Bannock when the warrior grunted dismissively.
"You do not agree?" "I do not know how their savage minds think, but I have faced a demon, and my only thought was of killing it, not also of raping and eating it."
Torek grimaced.
"Or of wearing human teeth and skin." "No."
Bannock's quiet, rusty laugh sounded.
"What do we do to Drapa but make armor of their skin and wear their claws to boast of our hunts? Why did you take the fur from the long-toothed cat?"
With widening eyes, Torek said in realization,
"We are the animals to them."
The old warrior shrugged.
"We cannot know for certain, but many savages I have seen crossing the lave seem to me like young Parsathians on their first Drapa hunt."
So that they might prove themselves as warriors. To Yven, that seemed as sensible an explanation as any. "And what would you rather face, Torek?" Yven asked. "A Drapa or a Farian?"
"A Drapa. They will only tear you apart and devour you."
Sudden pride swelled in Torek's voice, but the slurring of his words told her that the fever had him well in hold.
"And I have singly killed more Drapa than any other in my tribe."
The lift of his chin directed Yven's gaze to his neck, where a dozen raptor claws decorated a leather lace. She glanced at Keeler with a sly grin. "You are from the same tribe, Keeler, are you not?" "And he only wore three claws." Keeler made a disgruntled noise, but his amused look told Yven that her teasing was well met.
"At Torek's age, I'd already seen 2 years of fighting against Stranek's Fang, and there are a few Drapa south of the Burning Plains. When one is home longer, one can collect more claws."
Perhaps, but the number of claws Torek wore seemed no less impressive to Yven, especially as the young warrior could not be many years past his bearded age. "How long were you with the Alliance's army upon the lave?"
"Only 3 seasons.
"So after King Latan was assassinated the previous summer, and Madoc was sent to reassume command, Torek must have traveled south with him." "3 seasons only, yet you must have proved yourself well because you already serve in the Dragon Guard," she said. "Whoever appointed you to this task believed you would not falter when faced with revenants and wraiths." His fever-glazed eyes brightened.
"Someone must have told Enox of my bravery atop the Scourge."
"Oh, what is that story?"
"When the warriors in our tribe reached our hunter's age, we dared each other to stay a full night atop the ruins of the Scourge. I was the only one who remained until morning. The others were terrified by howls and screams, but I knew it must be the wind."
Crouching near the fire, Madoc bowed his head, shoulders silently shaking. Keeler wore a broad grin.
"The wind?"
"I recall a similar storm when we made our attempt to prove our bravery."
Artle joined them, dumping her furs onto the ground and sinking down cross-legged.
"But it was only a mudbrain who hoped to best Madoc and me."
The narrowed stare Artle leveled at the scarred warrior told Yvain who that mudbrain was.
Keeler?
He might have won, too, if we'd abandoned him to the Scourge. Instead, we went in loyal search of our friend, and in the canyon made when Silver-Fingered Ranny split the demon open, we found him howling and moaning, so that noise echoed through the whole cursed place.
Yvain laughed, but Torek shook his head, struggling to sit up as if to physically deny what Artle had suggested.
It could not have been Keeler. He was at the lathe.
Artle gave him a pitying look.
What of Sari?
She was home, but she could not...
Torek broke off, his frown deepening.
She is not even a hunter's age, and was then still in her milk teeth.
Take your ease, warrior,
Maddox said softly, but with unmistakable command. His breathing deep and ragged, as if merely sitting up had been a terrible effort, Torek nodded and eased back onto his furs. Yvain raised a skin of water to his dry lips.
Sari?
Keeler's sister, supplied Artle as Torek sipped, who is younger than half her brother's age, but already twice the warrior.
Keeler made no objection to that description, only nodded. But although Torek had eased back, again he shook his head.
A pack of Drapa have taken up a nest in the eye of the Scourge. She ought not to have gone near those ruins alone.
Keeler's grin slipped.
I will speak to her.
Artle scoffed. Will she listen?
I will speak to her,
Maddox said, and Artle did not scoff at that. Instead, it was Bannock who spoke next, his brow furrowed and his words precise, as if each one were carefully weighed and measured.
There has been a cold clutch upon my heart since I saw the whiptail rise. I thought it was merely worry, as more revenants still pursue us. Yet young Torek has made me think on the horrors I have seen, and realize that I have not seen power enough to raise a whiptail from the dead since the Destroyer's time.
Yvain cast him a confused glance. Did not the priests of Stranix Fang do the same?
In a method, it was the same, using a bird as a familiar and creating revenants from afar, yet never any revenant of that size. Usually those are raised by demons, not magic.
Bannock looked to Matic and Keeler as if for confirmation. Both men wore a slight frown.
Nothing that large,
Keeler agreed slowly.
So perhaps it was not Easel who sent them. Surely it would take an experienced sorcerer to raise such an animal.
Bannock shook his head.
Never would an experienced sorcerer allow himself to be flanked by Torek and Danil, or brought down as easily as this one was. He had no great control or awareness.
Dread clutched Yvain's throat. You think it was a demon, then?
No,
the old warrior said.
What demon would send a bird to see for him? More likely this is a sorcerer of great power but little practice.
Maddox's gaze touched Yvain's face.
Then perhaps Easel's bloodline gives his magics greater power.
Perhaps, she agreed, her heart full of unease. If true, Easel was a greater threat than her father. He cannot be allowed much more opportunity to practice. A wry smile twisted Maddox's lips.
The Alliance Council will not approve of you killing the king of another realm.
The Alliance's sole purpose is to defend against the Destroyer and those like him. If that is what my brother is becoming, then my arrow will soon put out his remaining eye. Maddox's smile became a scowl.
I am your strength, so I will do it for you.
Only if your aim is better and faster than mine, she retorted, because by the time I see my brother again, I'll have had plenty of opportunity to strengthen my arm. His expression darkened further, yet if Maddox meant to deny her, he did not before her view of him was blocked by Fassad crouching to examine Torek's leg.
You will see home again,
was the warrior's pronouncement. Yvain could not determine whether such a statement was truth or hope, and thought they might need more time to reach that home than planned. She looked to Maddox again and found him watching her with a brooding stare. If it was Easel who attacked us today, she said to him, then he must know we are headed to Draman and intend to sail north on the boiling sea. Should we not change course? His eyes narrowed.
To where?
Anywhere that her father could not so easily intercept them. No doubt news of their route was winging its way to Jalan now. He could send a full army to the outpost on the Burning Plains by the time their ship reached the northern shore. Which was what Maddox had hoped for. His vengeance could take but two routes, killing her father after marrying Yvain and helping her claim the Sissian throne, or killing her father in response to an attack within Parsathian territory. And her father's army would ride north. Unlike Maddox, Jalan had no alternatives. He would lose Sissia if he did not recapture Yvain. so he would take any risk, even one as foolish as attacking Parsath, or one that angered the Alliance Council. But if Matta killed her father near the outpost, he need not marry Yvain, and need not help her beyond that point, and she would be left with her father dead, but her brother still a threat, and with no protection or assistance. She needed him to marry her and have reason to help secure her throne, even if his only reason was to secure the Sisian throne for their children. "South," she said. "We should seek protection from the Gogian queen." His upper lip curled into a sneer.
"The selfsame queen who wished to be more like your father?"
"Because she wished to quiet dissent stirred by hungry farmers, but we would go to her with the promise of cooperation between Sisia, Parsath, and Gog that would alter the balance within the Alliance Council and ease the burden upon her people. She would have every reason to protect us, and if our marriage is witnessed by the Gogian queen, my father has no hope of challenging our union before the Alliance Council. Then I only need give birth to claim my throne." His expression hardened.
"You would have us cower behind Gogian walls until that day?"
Seeking protection was not cowering, but she knew it useless to tell him so. "Better than killed by the soldiers from the outpost."
"It is your father who will die there."
Abruptly he stood.
"We continue north."
Her chest was painfully tight as she watched him stalk away. So they would continue north, toward the vengeance Matic preferred. A vengeance where she was unneeded, except as bait for her father. With a heavy grunt, Keeler got to his feet and signaled to Danil.
"We will follow him and take first watch."
Snorting, Ardal rolled out her furs. "When you are behind him, try to pluck the thorn from his ass." Keeler nodded, his gaze flicking to Yvain. She knew not what he saw upon her face that prompted him to say,
"You might think him in a foul and angry mood, but it is only that his youngest warrior is fevered and his bride is in danger."
No, Matic had been in this foul mood since the whiptail, when she had saved them from danger. Yet there was nothing to do but nod. Perhaps it truly was worry for Torek, but it certainly was not care for her. Chapter 22. Matic. A bright egg moon shone down upon green marshes teeming with herds. Armorbacks snorted and squatted over dirt-mounded nests. Shaggy bison calves kicked their heels and danced between the column-like legs of dappled trumpeters. At the deep, resounding call from one of those great beasts, hundreds more raised long, elegant necks, their plumed heads turning as one. Atop the remains of a giant marble foot, Matic looked in the same direction. If any more revenants lived, they would soon catch up to the warriors. But it was not a revenant that alarmed the trumpeters. Instead, a Sabinar slinked toward the herds. Though reptilian-skinned and several times larger than a long-toothed cat, in movement it more resembled that animal than other reptiles, and its saber-like fangs resembled the cat's as well.
"The bison calf,"
Keeler predicted from beside him. This was a game they'd often played as boys, watching the predators of the burning plains and making wagers over which animal would be targeted. But this night Keeler only played it to keep himself awake. Though weighed by fatigue, Matic doubted sleep would come for him. But it was not the dangers outside the camp that occupied his mind. His gaze turned toward Yvain again. Hanan's mountainous head was buried almost to the eyes, and they had made camp in the corner of cheek and nose. The foot where he and Keeler kept watch was a longer distance away, but it offered the best vantage in all directions. They did not want to notice a revenant coming when it was already almost upon them. Ardal, Fasad, and Bannock slept now but would awaken at any noise, and Danil and Keeler had both eyes on their surroundings and could keep watch over the sleeping warriors, and over Yvain and Torek, one stricken by fever, and the other who had cared for him through first watch. A small fire still burned. By its soft light, he watched his bride bathe Torek's face with cool water. The warrior moved restlessly under her ministrations, muttering in a feverish delirium. It was she whom Matic wanted to keep in sight now, for when she was not, it seemed as if a revenant's poison filled his own chest, as it had ever since he'd yanked his sword from a revenant's gut and turned to see her coming toward him with Keeler's bow and arrow, instead of fleeing the magic-fouled whiptail. She had promised to make his life a misery. He still believed she would. But in that moment he'd realized his life would also be a greater misery if Yvain wasn't in it. A misery with her or without her. Of the two miseries, he would choose what she offered, yet that choice had almost been taken from him today. It was not the first time she'd been in danger. Yet when the blood wraiths had surrounded her, Matic's fear then had been nothing compared to today's. He meant to make her a warrior queen, but only so she could protect herself if necessary, not so that she could race toward battle. His next lesson to her would be that sometimes a warrior's best option was to run away. With a grunt, Keeler made a wordless comment on Maddox's distraction and how much of this night he'd spent looking toward the camp instead of watching for threats coming from outside it. Then his friend said gruffly,
"Do not look at your bride tending to Torek and think of fool's thoughts."
No need to ask what thoughts those would be, suspicion and jealousy. Maddox did not suspect either Torek or Yvenne, yet he could not truthfully deny shameful jealousy, because Yvenne tended to the young warrior with warmth and without walls. She did not so easily touch Maddox. But he could only agree.
Such thoughts would be a fool's, so do not think them. He has taken sweet liking to her, but it will pass as soon as another pretty woman shows him interest, and her eyes are only for you.
That was truth. At no one else did she ever look at with her gaze full of heat and hunger, except for Maddox and a millipede's leg. Keeler eyed him speculatively.
Were they also a fool's words? There must be a reason she slept with the wolves and then refused to share your furs last eve.
Maddox wished the words he'd said had been mere jealousy. Instead, he'd almost torn out her tongue. He'd told her not to look to him for affection, though it was Maddox who'd needed that reminder, not she. But he could not undo what was done.
The next time she allows me to share her bed, I will put my tongue to better use than saying what is best left unsaid.
Both pity and laughter filled the other warrior's reply.
It is but 5 days until the full moon.
When Maddox would have her again, and between now and then she would build stronger walls between them. Suddenly frowning, Keeler leaned forward.
What's got them up?
At the camp, Fassad and Bannock were no longer sleeping but had risen from their beds. As Maddox watched, Bannock nudged Ardal with his foot, but she only rolled over and burrowed deeper into her furs. No threat, then. Maddox glanced at the moon, still high, so it was too early to change watch. Bannock started in their direction. The older warrior gave a signal that all was well, yet Maddox did not wait for him to reach them. He scaled his way down Hanan's marble foot, with Keeler close behind.
Has Torek worsened?
Maddox asked as they met.
He is no better or worse than he was,
Bannock said.
But his restless mutterings mean there is no sleep found in the camp, and if I am to be awake, better I make use of myself on watch. Fassad has decided the same.
Keeler nodded and said,
Better mutterings than silence.
So it was. In the campaign against Stranix Fang, they had seen warriors as strong and as young as Torek succumb to the fever, and always it was preceded by burning stillness. Torek was in danger, but not terrible danger. Most strong warriors who died from the fever were not bitten on a limb as he'd been, but nearer their heart or head. Yet someone as frail as Yvenne. That fever killed most, no matter where the bite was. Perhaps she might have been spared death, just as her goddess-touched mother had survived a different poison that ought to have killed her. But Yvenne's body had never been as strong as that warrior queen's. It would have taken but one scratch, one bite, yet she'd run toward danger instead of away. She was well, but still Maddox's chest ached. His bride had said he was adept at finding weaknesses. He could not ignore that she was becoming his, for he focused on a problem he didn't face instead of the one he did.
Will he have the strength to ride tomorrow?
It mattered not if Torek could sit a horse after they reached Drom and the ship that would carry them across the boiling sea, but it was still several days' ride to that city. Bannock shook his head.
Perhaps the next.
A full day lost, and with Sisian or Ragusian soldiers not far behind if they'd taken the southern river road.
I can stay with him while you ride ahead,
Bannock suggested.
No.
They were all stronger together, even with Torek weakened, and if the soldiers had taken the northern road and reached Drom before they did, better not to enter that city with fewer warriors at his side.
If they are on this road, this position is the most defensible.
Keeler's mouth twitched in amusement.
And you have a bride who can place an arrow through any approaching soldier's eye.
So she could, but not alone, and Maddox would not expose her to the soldiers. Yet if an attack came, he would also be a fool not to use such a gift. Nor would she let him leave it unused. By Temra's fist, her stubbornness meant that if he denied her, she would only seek strength elsewhere. That poisonous ache in his chest deepened. He felt Keeler's gaze upon him now before the other warrior said,
Are you in need of counsel, Ran Maddox?
Though the warrior's tone was light, it wasn't all jest. Counsel and consultation was one of the dragon's duties, and whatever Maddox's friend saw upon his face must have said he was in need of it. But it was not counsel he needed. There was no help for what afflicted him.
Not counsel, a promise.
But not from Keeler, though it was best that the warrior witnessed it. Maddox looked to Bannock. Maddox's guards did not have to obey him. But if the older warrior made that vow now, it would be near the same.
You serve as one of my dragon guards, but foremost you will serve as my bride's. And if she will not run from a threat we cannot defeat, you will take her away from it.
Bannock looked to Keeler. Maddox had no doubt the old man wanted to accept, yet this would be a decision made between the warriors, for it might mean Bannock would abandon the dragon and Maddox in a time of need. The lightness had vanished from his friend's expression. Keeler misliked the request, but he also saw the reason for it, and he also knew Maddox's own frustration at not having realized it sooner.
We saw what she was. Every time she sensed foul magics or when she looked at us with her moonstone eyes and we could not hold her gaze, she told us a goddess sees through her. We knew.
His mouth twisted in bitter humor.
Yet even the barmaid understood better than we, and that only on a glance.
Just as so many things had been described to Yvain, but she'd not truly understood until seeing them for herself. Keeler and Maddox had been similarly blinded, believing that they knew what she was but having no true understanding of what they saw. Yet not every warrior had labored under the same misconceptions.
Bannock knew,
Maddox said to him.
He'd seen it before.
In Yvain's mother and in her mother's mother. But the old man shook his head.
I saw the goddess within her, but I was blind to more because I also saw that she was not the warrior her mother was. And after the ruins, when she failed to run, I didn't see how brave she was. I did not see that until today.
Maddox had seen her courage. He'd seen it from the moment her brother had pulled her from the carriage when she'd boldly lifted her chin and looked straight through him. Like a fool, he'd simply dismissed that courage. But now she was his weakness, and he could not let his weakness leave her vulnerable.
Will you protect her? Jalen will never let her be. None of that family will.
And Maddox had new reason to kill them all. Yvain had claimed she was more valuable as a bride than a corpse, but he'd not fully understood what she meant, even after recognizing how valuable she was as a queen. Her daughters would have legitimate claim to the Sisian throne, yet even that was not all her worth. For her daughters would also carry a goddess's magic within her, and Jalen and her brothers could not control Yvain. But a young and powerful girl without the influence of a queen like Yvain's mother? Perhaps they could. Perhaps the only reason it had not already been done to Yvain was because of her frailty and weakness. If she'd been as strong as her mother had once been, Jalen would have raised her as he did his sons. Now, if Yvain had a daughter, Jalen would take the baby, kill the mother, then mold the child in the same image as he molded his sons. They hungered for power too much to ever relinquish a claim over her. Little wonder Jalen meant to marry her to the Tolehi king. Not only would her father have new claim to that throne, but the Tolehi king would not have fought when Jalen took Yvain's female issue.
Until her father and her brothers are dead, she will never be safe.
Bannock agreed, then added solemnly,
If Nyset's line ends or is corrupted by Jalen, that would be a great loss, not only to Sisia, but to all who call themselves her allies. So I swear it. My first duty will be to Yvain.
Though Maddox was relieved by the vow, the ache in his chest didn't vanish. A great loss. But not just losing Nyset's line, losing Yvain herself would be a loss, and Yvain's children would be a gain for the Parsathians. Maddox's children. Keeler's eyes narrowed.
And we can do the same to you.
Maddox grunted. He knew not what the other man meant.
If you do not run from a threat we cannot defeat, we will make you go.
The warrior looked smug, as if he'd won an argument Maddox hadn't begun. But perhaps it only meant the argument had not been with him. This might have been discussed among the other members of the dragon. Perhaps as soon as he had begun this quest for vengeance, they had argued about whether to save Maddox from himself if his rage and grief overwhelmed his sense. He knew for certain his warriors must have questioned his sense when Bannock asked,
Why do we not change course now that Jalen must know our route north? They would not expect us to flee south to the Lave.
Or to seek help from the Gogian queen.
Keeler put in dryly, as Yvain had suggested, that his warriors listened to her so well pleased Maddox. Though he misliked the thought of hiding in Gog, it had been a sensible alternative, and his warriors had seen that too. Also sensible was Bannock's suggestion to flee past the city of Gog to the River Lave. It was a territory they knew well, and where they would find allies among the army who would stand with Maddox and a goddess-touched Sisian queen against her brother and her father.
But Ivan had been intended for Tole's king, and Matic knew not if the Tolehi captain who commanded the army now would stand against his uncle. There were Sisian soldiers who would surely be loyal to Ivan, just as those were upon the ambush road, yet they were small in number. And his lesson to Ivan would not be a false one. Sometimes a warrior's best option was to run. They needed more numbers, and they needed a defensible position and allies whose loyalties were not in conflict. They would find all in the north. Within the burning plains, Ivan would have an entire Parsathian army to protect her, and no need to rely on her bow.
Jalen cannot know our route yet. If it was Ezel who sent that eagle, her brother knows, but he is in Rugus. By the time word reaches Jalen of our route, we will be halfway across the boiling sea. We will see the fire bloom before Jalen's army reaches the outpost, and if he brings soldiers out of Sisia with him, all of Parsath will soon know it.
Because such movement would be seen, and an alarm sent out to all corners of the burning plains, but the alarm would not need to travel far, for many of the clans were already gathering near Kilrin, so they might choose their new ran. Keeler nodded.
So we are in a race. A race we cannot win if we leave this road,
Matic said. So they might have to face the soldiers from Ephorn, but it would not be an army that pursued them. The soldiers would have been sent to seek Ivan and a small party of Parsathians. They would be mounted for speed and their numbers few, because Sisia and Rugus kept few mounted soldiers in Ephorn. But even if the council added the Alliance's guard to their number, Matic expected no more than a battalion.
So we'd best pray to Enam for swift winds upon the boiling sea,
Bannock added, though the tension had eased from his face.
Do not pray too well, or Enam might scent a storm. Better to pray to Nemec to cool a fever and suck out poison,
Keeler said, looking toward the camp. Matic had no intention of praying to either god. It seemed like wishing for what was not. What he had instead was a bride who soothed Torek's fevered brow. Though Fassad had taken over that task now. As Matic and Keeler approached the camp, Ivan no longer sat beside the poisoned warrior, but had settled onto her furs, the green stave she used to strengthen her arm across her lap. She was tying back the flowing sleeves of her robe, as if she intended to practice more before she slept. Her pale gaze caught Maddox as he collected Bannock's furs for himself, and then she looked at him questioningly when he held out his hand to help her up.
Come,
he said.
We will make our beds in a quieter location, and discard that stave.
Even with a goddess's sight and aim, no arrow would fly true from that weapon. She remained seated, gripping the bow tighter. But I need to—
Use Ardal's instead,
he told her. Ardal's bow was too long for Yvain's arm, but was the shortest they had, and if his bride needed the weapon for more than practice, it would be Maddox's arm that pulled the string. The bow would not be too long then.
She prefers her glaive anyway.
A grunt of agreement came from the warrior's furs. The happiness that lit Yvain's face was as bright as it had been that morning when Maddox had first given her the stave, and almost as bright as after they had felled the whiptail. The constriction within Maddox's chest tightened at the sight, but it was not the same poisonous pain that festered. This he knew not what it was, but the answering heaviness in his loins was clear enough. Then his arousal was forgotten as she reached for the bow Keeler had fetched from Ardal's belongings. Yvain's blood darkened the linen wrappings formerly hidden by her sleeves. Keeler froze at the sight. Maddox did not. Dropping to a crouch beside her, he snagged her wrist and gently turned it. A stripe of dried blood crossed the inside of her forearm. His gut clenched sickly as he realized what the injury was, and that it was likely not the only one.
Show to me your other arm.
Her brow furrowed as if she puzzled over their reaction, and she showed him. The same stripe, but with more blood, from three distinct slashes, Matic knew, instead of just one. The first from the strike of the bowstring when they'd felled the whiptail. The others, after he'd told her to take the bow in her opposite hand, and they'd felled three more revenants. Shame was like anger, hot and thick in his chest and throat, for it had been his strength behind the pull of that string. The first arrow they'd loosed, the one that had killed the whiptail, he could not have undone. But if he'd known the first had hurt her, never would he have continued. He battled his own tongue until the words of shame would not erupt like rage. Still, they were harsh and hot.
Why did you not tell me the bowstring had done this?
Because it must have hurt. It must have been a streak of agony, as if she'd been slashed by a blade or lashed with a whip. Still, she looked at him in bafflement, and a slight wariness, as if choosing her words very carefully. It is but the cost of mastery. Choosing them carefully, because she must have first heard them from his mother. Ivan had changed the words,
His mother would have called it the price of practice, but now Matic recalled the scars he'd seen on her forearm. This was not the first time she'd bled from a bowstring, and clearly his bride thought she must bleed until she mastered the skill. Perhaps in that tower that had been true. Here it was not. He glanced up at Keeler.
She will need an archer's brace.
It will be ready by morning,
the warrior said.
A guard for her fingers, too,
Matic told him, for the fingertips she used to draw the bowstring were blistered and raw. He'd known they would be tender until calluses formed, for that was the price of practice. But he'd not known when he'd given her the stave how relentlessly she would use it, and he did not believe she would ease up her practice now simply because of blisters and blood.
As a queen, you do not cry when you are in pain, and I will not ask you to,
Matic said to her in a low voice.
But if you wish to be a warrior, you must tell us when you have been wounded. A warrior has the duty and the honor of tending to a fellow warrior's injuries, just as you have tended to Torek. Do not deny us the honor of tending to you.
Her moonstone gaze searched his features before she looked to the others. Keeler and Fassad gazed back at her with solemn faces. Even Ardal sat up in her furs now, regarding Yven with a grave expression. He could well imagine what they felt now, shame similar to his, if not as deep, for being the cause of her injury. For she had saved all their lives that day, and then had gone about untended and bleeding for the rest of it. I will not deny you, she promised softly, then louder again so they all heard. I will tell you of it next time. Matic would rather there not be a next time, but her response would serve for this night.
I will tend to her,
he told the others, though they knew it would be he who did. She made no protest when he scooped her up, furs and all, only pausing long enough for Keeler to give her Ardal's bow and a quiver of arrows. No more practicing would Matic allow before she had protection for her fingers and arm, but if threat came during the night, better she have the weapon within reach. Carrying her, he started off toward the statue's hand, which lay southwest of the head. With Yven cradled in his arms, the poisonous ache in his chest began to ease. Another ache started lower, but that he would ignore until her injuries were seen to. Then he would ignore it no longer. He had not successfully lured Yven outside her walls, but although she was becoming his weakness, her desire made her vulnerable to him in return. So he would steal his way over those walls again and again until she finally invited him in. He felt her gaze upon his face for the first steps. When they passed beyond the statue's ear, she made a soft exclamation of wonder. She had been too focused on Torek to make much note of their surroundings when they'd arrived, so although she'd widened her eyes at the size of the head and foot, she had seen none of the statue that lay behind those enormous ruins because they had blocked her view. Now the moonlight gleamed over the white marble, rendering it as pale and as bright as her moonstone eyes were in sunlight. Parts of the ancient sculpture had been buried by time, such as an arm completely covered by an earthen hill. Other parts were completely bare, like the foot Matic had kept watch upon. This, too, was described to me, but I never imagined. She trailed off, her face awestruck. Matic hadn't imagined the statue properly either, and he still could not imagine it, not truly. Hanan's legendary statue had once stood beside the mighty Agaras, which the god had created with his tears and his seed. But the toe Matic had climbed was 3 times his own height, so he could hardly fathom how tall the statue in entirety must have been. The Tower of the Moon in Ephorn could have served as the ankle and calf and still barely reached the knee, yet Matic didn't think that city's tower would endure through the ages as this statue had. For the sculpture had broken and fallen apart, but the marble hadn't crumbled. It was buried in places, yet no weeds grew from cracks in the stone. The surface hadn't pitted and weathered, though the statue had been already in pieces when Ranbantik had united the tribes, and the river on whose banks it once stood now flowed farther north, barely visible in the distance. Only the river road they traveled on was as ancient. I had not known they built a tower, too, she said now, her voice wondering and her chin tipped back as she gazed up at a shining column of marble. Is the base uncovered? Can it be entered?
Matic grinned. That is not a tower. That is Hanan's pride.
The god's colossal cock, and perhaps more colossal than Matic knew, for the lower part of the shaft was buried too, yet what jutted above the ground was nearly as long as the statue's leg must have been. After a moment of stunned silence, a giggle shook through her slight form. Even in ruins he is upright.
Because Hanan was always erect. At least we need not fear that it would soften and crush us.
Surely he will never wilt, she agreed, and eyed the tip speculatively.
Do you think it ever erupts? Matic could not speak again until they had reached the hand, and he had to stop laughing long enough to climb the fingers while carrying her. There she drew another awestruck breath as she saw what Matic had spotted from his perch atop the foot. A pool filled the statue's palm, the glow of the marble through the clear water seeming as if the moon itself were trapped within its depths.
We must remove our shoes, she whispered reverently, as if they entered a temple, and Matic could not disagree. He set his bride on her feet, and she placed her bow and quiver aside before bending at the waist, reaching for the ribbons of her sandals, reaching with her blistered fingers. Matic dumped the furs and knelt before her, catching her wrists.
I will tend to you, Yvain.
Her eyes met his. The slightest hesitation passed over her features before she nodded and straightened again.